Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pilucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, our topic today is intuition.
Ooh.
Yes, we're going to talk about what intuition really is, like what people mean when they talk about intuition, where our intuitions come from, whether intuition and reason are opposed, like whether there are alternative methods of drawing conclusions about the world or whether they're compatible in some way, and when intuition might be useful, if it can be useful, and when it can be particularly misleading.
So the word intuition comes from the Latin, as a lot of words do, intuir, and intuir means knowledge from within. So, which is, I think, actually a pretty good description of how most people think about intuition, right? That there's something inside us that tells us what to do.
Right. So I think that's a great umbrella definition, but it still leaves open the question of that knowledge from within. Where did that knowledge come from, right? I mean, so the word is sometimes used to mean knowledge that you've sort of built up over time through practice and experience, which, you know, has all been sort of stored in some way in your brain, but which you don't have like conscious deliberative access to.
Right.
So you might have an intuition about a situation as being dangerous, even though you aren't consciously thinking about, well, here are the reasons it's dangerous. There's just, you've learned patterns and rules, and or, you know, maybe a chess player, an expert chess player, might have an intuition that a certain move will be good. And that's just something he's developed through years and years, thousands and thousands of games. He's learned that certain patterns on the board tend to reward certain kinds of moves. So that that kind of intuition is actually can be quite reliable because it's based on actual data, as long as it's being synthesized properly in an unbiased way.
But that one is domain specific.
That is domain specific, yes. And I actually, looking back, the first example I gave of feeling like a situation might be dangerous without being able to articulate exactly why. That's a bit of a misleading example, I now realize, because it sort of blurs into the second category of intuition, which is intuitions that come from some sort of innate or evolved predisposition.
That's right, an instinct.
An instinct, which might be relevant in the current modern context at hand, and it might not.
Right.
We might have an instinct that people who are attractive are more likely to be telling the truth, but that kind of halo effect.
I don't know how that ever came about, even in evolutionary time. I don't know that was ever true.
Yeah, but so it's hard to look back and see what the roots were of things like this because in the ancestral environment we weren't trying to convince each other of things. So somehow our brains are trying to extrapolate in the way they work from how they were evolved to work. And somehow that has resulted in us trusting attractive people more. But anyway, and then the third main category of intuition that I've noticed, or way of referring to intuition that I've noticed people use, is as sort of like a supernatural sixth sense.
Right.
So yes, it comes from within you, but the question of where that knowledge within you came from is just left with this sort of Mysterian question mark, you know?
Right.
It's just in there and you just know. And there's not any attempt made at an explanation of how you just know, you know? Even if you're not consciously figuring something out, like, you would think there's still some reason that you're having the intuition you do, but that tends to be left intentionally blank.
Right. So one thing that I think we should clear out right at the beginning is that there is actually research on intuition, so we're not just using our intuition to talk about intuitions. There is quite a bit of research in cognitive science in the last several years, and in fact, most of it, I shouldn't say most of it, but a good chunk of it actually does deal with things like chess playing, because that's clearly an activity that you can do deliberately and through rational explicit rational thinking, but it's also clearly an area where, as you said, the more expert you become, the more actually you shift to sort of intuitive response and heuristics that you developed by practice.
Yeah, I think they've done some experiments where they had expert chess players play something like 10 games in parallel. So clearly they didn't have the cognitive resources to be devoting to each particular game. Right. And yet they still did really well. The only explanation being that they were using these intuitive heuristics for what were good moves. And
even more telling experiment about chess is this one in which the chess players were first put in front of a actual situation on the chessboard, meaning a situation that can actually occur on the chessboard, they were asked what to do, and they of course got it right most of the time because they were familiar, if not with the specific situation, certainly they developed a sort of a sense of what would work under similar circumstances.
Right. And when you say a situation that could occur, you mean like an arrangement of pieces that you could end up arriving at if you started with the normal beginning and like made moves.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they were put in front of a situation that actually was completely random. There was not actually a likely situation or that it could not possibly occur under normal conditions of a game, in which case their intuitions about what to do, even a chess master intuition about what to do, was just as good as any novice.
Oh, wow.
Because there's
That's
nothing.
Such a striking
result. It was pretty
that.
Striking. Now, so those experiments and others in other domains of expertise, such as, for instance, being a nurse, or teaching mathematics, there's all sorts of research similar research that's been done in these other domain of expertise. They all seem to point out that there is certainly such a thing as intuition that is domain specific. But there isn't any such thing as being generally intuitive. So when somebody says to you, "Oh, I'm an intuitive person," that is nonsense. There's no such thing as an intuitive person. Although the only caveat that one can possibly have about that is that there is such a thing presumably about being intuitive about social situations. Right. Mm-hmm. So if when somebody says I'm an intuitive person, they actually mean I have a good sense of social situations and how to react or navigate them.
Right,
that actually is possible.
Right.
That's
possible.
Right, because that is a domain of expertise in some sense. But being intuitive across the board makes no sense.
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the main misinterpretations of Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, the popular science book that was published a few years back.
Same. Yes.
That I skimmed it. I don't remember the particulars of the book. But I know that that at least based on the evidence that he gives in that book, the thesis, whether he makes this explicit or not, is that intuition can lead to better results if you have a lot of expertise in that particular domain.
Right.
But the way that it's generally quoted when people talk about it, colloquially, is that relying on your intuition, in sort of snap judgments in general, will lead to better outcomes than, deliberative reasoning.
Yeah. That is actually the most of not the case. And in fact, again, there's quite an interesting literature about it. Now, one of the things I wanted to point out is actually that apparently the first modern psychologist to think along the lines of intuition and rational decision-making as two different but interacting processes was none other than the father of modern psychology, William James.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually distinguished basically the two modes of cognition. Intuition, according to James, works in an associative manner. It feels effortless, so it's fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it works without essentially the subject realizing what's going on. On the other hand, rational thinking is analytical. It does require effort, and it's much slower, but it tends to be more accurate. So there are those situations where, it's easy to come up with examples, where, because you do not have enough time, you're under time constraint or other time constraints, you actually do need to rely on the intuition. But it's also easy to come up with examples where the intuition actually fails, especially one of the most common area where intuitions fail is probability theory.
Right. Base rate neglect, I think, is one of my favorite examples, where they'll ask people, the common example is that there's a test, say for breast cancer, and the test has breast cancer, occurs in 1 out of every 1,000 women in the relevant population, and the test has a false positive rate of say 5%. And so the question presented to subjects is, let's say a person tests positive for breast cancer, what is the chance that that person actually has the disease? Knowing nothing else about the person's symptoms and signs and so on. And And so people know that the test, you know, is occasionally wrong. So they say, you know, well, you know, false positive rate of 5%, maybe it's, you know, like 90% chance or 85% chance that the person actually has breast cancer. The correct answer is 2%. So wildly off. And the problem there is that people are not taking into account the base rate of breast cancer in the population. So breast right. cancer is so rare in the population, 1 in 1,000, that even if you get a positive result on this test, it's still much more likely that the test was wrong than that you actually have breast cancer. And so, yeah, this is a systematic bias that we have, that we neglect the base rate and we overweight the recent evidence, or, you know, the case specific evidence.
And that's a great example of what you were saying a few minutes ago, which is, you know, that is clearly an area probability estimates in fairly complex situations. It's clearly an area where you wouldn't expect evolution to have owned much of a you know, instinct, because right. we hardly had to deal with complex situations like
right.
that.
Oh, and I should also qualify what I just said, that the problem as it's traditionally presented is with percentages, mm-hmm. you know, the percentage of the population, what percent of the time is a test wrong. But when you rephrase the question in terms of frequencies, so you say, you know, 1 in 1,000 people, or, you know, 5 in 100 times, that sort of thing, then people are much more able to get the right answer,
right.
which does, it totally fits with the explanation that we're used to thinking in, you know, numbers of things. We're not used to thinking in terms
Correct.
Of percentages.
Correct.
So our intuitions have evolved in that way. And I should also mention that even medical students and staff and doctors tend to get this question wrong at
right.
a much higher rate than you would hope.
Yeah, so this, you know, probability theory is complex enough that actually does require quite a bit of training, and so that explains why most people don't have correct intuitions about probability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that to point out, I want to go back for a minute to James' distinction between sort of the two modes of operating or processing information in the brain, which I'm sure it's a simplification, because the brain operates in, you know, probably many more than just two basic categories. But those are distinct enough and interesting enough for our purposes. Now, we've talked in the past often about the fact that, of course, these days you can't talk about X without talking about the neurobiology of X. And in this case, it's intuition, and there's no exception. So now the research today is interesting for a variety of reasons. One bit of information I want to point out, because it does help make sense of what most people think of intuitions and why so many people are so strongly attached to their intuitions. So, you know, the rational decision making involves, of course, the prefrontal cortex. It's where conscious thinking, rational thinking, and it's slow, as we said earlier. It's accurate, but it's slow, and it's time consuming and effort consuming. Now, if you look at the areas that tend to be more involved, according to neurobiologists, with intuition, on the other hand, these include the amygdala, the basal ganglia, the nucleus accumbens, the lateral temporal cortex, and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Now, the important one, or one of the important ones that I just mentioned, is the amygdala. Why? Because that's also the seat of strong emotional reactions. So apparently, one of the reasons we have this gut feeling about our intuitions, we're so sure that our intuitions are correct, it's because they are reinforced emotionally. They're connected emotionally mm-hmm. through the amygdala. So we really rely a lot on intuitions. We have the gut feeling is actually very strong. There's an emotional attachment which should not necessarily originate with with rational decision making, deliberation. So
mm-hmm.
so the neurobiology there helps actually to understand to yeah. parse this, the process and understand it better.
I just wanted to go back to something you said a bit earlier about the when deliberative reasoning can fail. I think you talked a bit about how deliberative reasoning can fail you when you don't have a lot of time. But there are actually a couple of other interesting cases where deliberative reasoning fails. First it can fail when there's just too many factors for you to consider. And so
right.
you just get overwhelmed and you end up picking in sort of a more random or arbitrary way in your deliberative reasoning attempt than you would if you just used intuition, where you would you would intuitively focus on a few of the most salient or you know, emotionally fraught, emotionally weighted aspects of the situation. You would just decide based on those. And that's not as good as being completely deliberative and taking everything into account, but it's still better than throwing up your hands and kind of picking
right.
randomly, which is what people tend to do when they get overwhelmed by all of the different factors.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other way that deliberative reasoning can fail people, there have been a few recent studies about this where people were asked to choose between, I think they tried a number of comparisons, like choose between cars to purchase, choose between yeah. insurance packages, a few other comparisons, usually of the sort of what do you want to purchase sort. And some subjects they asked to make the decision just intuitively or, you know, go with your gut. And some subjects were asked to, like, write out pros and cons or to, like, look at these tables of you know, what the mileage of the car is, what the costs of the different cars are,
right.
and, like, add, you know, weights to the different factors and come up with a total score for each car and make your decision that way. And for the most part, the people in that deliberative reasoning group tended to be less happy with the choice that they eventually made. And the interpretation was that people, when asked to pay attention to these, like when asked to use deliberative reasoning, people pay attention to quantifiable things like the mileage of the car and the cost and so on. But they don't know how to quantify things like their subjective liking of the car. So they just leave that out of their calculation. But that's right. obviously a really important factor in whether you're going to end up happy with your choice.
Right.
And just because you can't quantify it doesn't mean it's not rational. That's right. a typical fallacy that I hear people make. Like, clearly, if it affects your happiness, it is rational to take it into account.
Absolutely.
Right.
Even though not be able to quantify.
Yeah, and of course, it is impossible to precisely quantify. But even, you know, even acknowledging that it's important and trying roughly to quantify right. how much you like it would go a long way towards making these kinds of calculations more effective.
Right. I want to mention research that I encountered that I found very interesting. Again, going back to this interaction between the intuitive processing and sort of the rational deliberation processing of information. So this is by Adam Alter at Princeton, and he had also collaborators at Harvard and the University of Chicago. And so this group published a number of papers over the last few years on these issues. So one of the things they did was to show that there are standard situations where people switch from intuitive to explicit analysis of a given problem, and mm-hmm. they investigated under what condition this happens. And so they found that usually what happens is that people switch from intuitive to explicit analysis when they have something personal at stake. In the outcome, like if they're likely to lose money on a bad decision or something like that, then they trust their intuition less, and they're more careful, more deliberate about it. And also, if people are if people are under time pressure or they experience what is called a cognitive load, so mm-hmm. they're busy doing a bunch of other things at the same
right.
time, then they will rely on intuition because it's faster. It's a heuristic. Now, Alter and his colleagues have also investigated the effect of what they call disfluency, and I found this fascinating. So, disfluency is a measure of how comfortable you are with the information that you're receiving.
And how comfortable?
Yes. So comfortable as no. As in the way how easily you can process that information.
Okay.
So, for instance. They argue that neurologically, from a neurological perspective, disfluency triggers the anterior cingulate cortex, which activates the prefrontal cortex, where much of our analytical thinking is done. So the more disfluent the information is, the more likely you are to engage the rational, deliberative decision-making. Now, how do you make people disfluent about mm-hmm. things? So in one case, they simply gave the same problem to solve to people. But in one case, they wrote it in clearly legible type font. And in another case,
right.
they wrote it in a type font that was a bit more difficult to read. And they controlled for the fact that it wasn't just the slowing down that caused the difference,
mm-hmm.
because you can manipulate the time that people spend on the problem independently. And so it was just the fact that the people had to make more of an effort to read the more difficult font that switched them from intuitive to deliberative decision making.
I think I've heard about this in the context of moral decision making, that people are more likely
yeah.
to use intuitive
That's
first.
Right.
I think Joshua Knobe alluded to this research when
mm-hmm.
he was our guest.
That's right. There is an equivalent in moral decision making.
Yeah.
Now, here, get this.
Okay.
You can cause yourself disfluency.
Huh.
And in a very easy way. So if you want to force yourself to switch from intuitive to deliberative decision making,
uh-huh.
apparently the only thing you need to do is to furrow your brows.
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
so
wow.
That it mimics the sort of the typical...
I'm a thinker now.
Yeah, I'm a thinker, right? The typical expression we associate with thinking. Well, that's enough to trigger the areas of the brain that are involved in deliberative thinking. And so you are actually a thinker, as it turns out, if you just act like a thinker.
Wow.
I thought that was just fascinating.
And,
yeah.
And kind of pathetic.
It is kind of pathetic. But, you know, next time you want to put your thinking cap... I have a thinking cap in my office at Lehman College.
Sometimes I can't tell when you're being
that actually is true.
Literal?
I didn't make it. Yeah,
you have a thinking cap.
I do.
What does it look like?
It's basically an inverted lampshade of metal that somebody previously in the office labeled thinking cap, and I don't use it. But
okay,
but
photo for the website.
Yes,
next time
we need a photo.
So you were saying you have a thinking gap, and then I derailed you.
Right. No, so the point of these experiments is that it's remarkably easy to manipulate, basically, either even in a self-induced way, the balance between intuition and deliberate thinking, depending on what's at stake, on whether you have cognitive load from other tasks, or even simply from... taking the attitude of adopting the attitude of a thinker, you sort of switch things around. It's I think it's, you know, useful hint.
I bet that could be really useful information for, say, charities when they're trying to persuade people that a problem is important based on statistics. You know, people's inclination usually is to be more persuaded by like a moving story than to be persuaded by, look, these tens of thousands of, you know, people are suffering, or these tens of thousands of creatures are dying, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So maybe the statistics would have more impact on people, or maybe people would be more willing to see like the potential benefit of their dollars donated or something if the charity, you know, printed their letter in a really hard to read font or something like that.
That's right.
I talked earlier about how deliberative reasoning can go awry, but there's a few other examples of how intuitive reasoning can go awry that we haven't touched on yet that I think are interesting. There are these evolutionarily programmed cases that we mentioned where, you know, the current situation is not relevant to the situation which our intuitions were programmed. And then there are sort of these like probabilistic reasoning errors we have. But there's also, in general, I think a good rule to follow that intuition tends to be less reliable in cases where the problem you're considering is not something that you have experience with in the past, or it's sort of an unprecedented problem. Like say you're trying to decide how likely artificial intelligence is to lead to, you know, some sort of catastrophe. You might rely on your intuition, but you have to consider the fact that your intuition in this case it just has no similar problems to have been shaped on. Like, you know, a problem like artificial intelligence or any other kind of existential risk, we don't have any examples like that. So it's hard to think that we could rely on our intuition to tell us what's going to happen or what we should do. And similarly, in problems like this, there tend to be... you can often notice other factors that have contributed to your intuition that shouldn't have, like epistemically. Like, you know, if, again, to take the example of artificial intelligence, if you're using your intuition to consider how dangerous that might be, you have to think about the fact that your intuition is probably shaped by fiction because you've read a lot of stories about robot apocalypses and, you know, AI explosions that took over the world. There are not very many stories about AI going in a nice, boring, pleasant way. So I guess the takeaway here is that being able to recognize where your intuition comes from can help you decide when it's a good guide in a particular problem.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I want to come back also to this idea of expertise, because as it turns out, there is research that shows how intuition and deliberative thinking interact over time to build expertise. As it turns out, simplifying things a little bit, there are, broadly speaking, three phases to becoming an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually... The interesting thing that I found in the literature on expertise is that they're remarkably similar, almost regardless of the field of expertise you're talking about. So these three phases that I'm about to discuss in a minute apply whether you want to become a chess master or a tennis player, professional tennis player, or whatever in between. So it's mm-hmm. It's both sort of intellectual as well as sort of practical applications. All right. So the first phase is when the beginner focuses her attention simply on understanding what it is that needs to be done, the task at hand, right? And basically, mostly on not making mistakes. Think of the first time you start trying to learn to drive a car, for instance, right? You need conscious attention and to a lot of different things, and particularly to avoid mistakes, especially mistakes that can cost somebody's life or your car at least. Now, in the second phase, this kind of conscious attention shifts toward about the basic tasks. Shifts toward a more intuitive level. So the individual performs things quasi-automatically. Again, think about driving a car. Your body and your mind memorize and internalize the basic movements, so you can actually drive a car now when you're listening to the radio or talking to somebody else, hopefully not on the phone or not texting, but nonetheless, you can do a lot of other things. And you're much more relaxed because there's a lot that goes on that's actually being shifted automatically to the unconscious. Now, here's the problem. So the good news is that usually it takes, in whatever the field is, it takes actually a fairly short period of time to go from the first to the second phase. The bad news is it takes a lot more time and effort to get from the second to the third phase. In this case, in the example of the driving, if you want to become, a NASCAR driver or a Formula Uno driver or something like that, or a chess master. What happened is that the initial improvement was aided by switching control from conscious thought to intuition, all right? Then until the task becomes automatic and faster. But then further improvement requires actually mindful attention, focus on the areas where you still make mistakes. Okay. And that is actually, and it requires a lot of effort, a conscious effort to correct those mistakes. This is in fact often referred to as deliberate practice. So this is the situation where, let's say, a soccer player or a tennis player that are good enough, they're actually pretty good. They have a good intuition about the game and everything, but they still make mistakes in terms of, they need to correct the form of, certain details of what they do. That one becomes very difficult because your brain has automated a lot of that stuff. And now it's sort of, now it's up to you to sort of go back into the subconscious and fish out the stuff that you're not doing well and focus your attention mindfully. Exactly. Yeah. De-automate until you understand where the mistake is, corrected, and then re-automate. And the bad news, as I said, is that this is a lot of hard work and it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I think that's actually really useful information because I've often found myself in situations where I'm like, oh, I'd like to become better at, oh Lord, like what? Let's say, I don't know, small talk. Let's say I'd like to become better at small talk.
Oh yeah, I want to do that too. So let me know
I was just going to say that I tend to gravitate towards the assumption that I can just do a lot of it and I will gradually become better. But I always sort of had this sneaking suspicion that I might have to actually work harder at becoming better at it instead of just doing it a lot and hoping that it just gradually, improves itself in my brain.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that's what you're saying.
Unfortunately, it turns out you need mindful attention apparently. Now this last phase of sort of moving from somebody who is simply good at doing a certain thing to actually becoming an expert, as I said, it's actually remarkably similar across fields, and it's measured into the several tens of thousands of hours, which basically means roughly about 10 years to become an expert in a particular field. And the levels of expertise themselves can actually be, you can have more than one level of expertise. So, for instance, in the case of chess players, which is one of, as we said earlier, one of the cases that where most studies have been done, it takes about 10 years to become a professional player, but it takes then another 10 years or so to become a master level player. And by the way, that has very little to do with sort of native ability. Some people think that, but there are some geniuses who are really good and all that. Well, as it turns out, even the geniuses do need to do mindful practice to actually become masters. Even if you have a talent for something, first of all, a lot of the times talent is actually simply being precocious about something. It's not that you're necessarily much better than other people. It's that you get there much earlier in life. But even when there is native talent, if you want to move from talent to actual mastering and expertise, you still need to go to this mindful attention phase, which unfortunately it's pretty long. There doesn't seem to be a shortcut for that one.
I just wanted to point out that I've noticed a number of, there's a lot of objections to the idea of rationality from sort of the general population, but most interesting to me are the objections to rationality from like smart, educated, empirically minded,
presumably rational,
presumably pretty rational people who will say things like, well, you know, you don't want to be too rational. And so I gave this talk at Skepticon last fall about trying to explore where these ideas come from. It was called the Straw Vulcan. So I was talking about this sort of caricature of rationality that you see in movies and TV, like the Vulcans.
Yeah,
in
Star Trek. I'm going just now in this last few weeks through the entire Star Trek original series, so I know exactly.
Fun. Yeah, I had video clips from the original series in my talk to illustrate the different misconceptions about rationality.
You know, I didn't realize how in the first season, especially, things changed later in the second and third seasons. The original Star Trek only lasted three seasons. But in the first, although there were long seasons, there were 25 episodes per season. But in the first season, McCoy is really nasty to Spock.
Yeah, he really is.
You know, later on, they develop this more playful thing. But initially, the guy is really on his case. It's like, wow.
Yeah, they sort of, like, the writers decided we need a foil, you know? And they just, like, went with that 120%.
All right, so what about the story?
Oh, right. So I just wanted to say that one of the reasons that I've perceived generally rational people to believe things like, it's possible to be too rational, is that they're conflating the rational irrational distinction with the system intuitive deliberative distinction. Uh-huh. I was about to say system one, system two, and then I remembered we haven't used those terms yet in this podcast. But that's actually
but we can do that.
That's actually a common way that psychologists or, you know, cognitive psychologists talk about intuition and deliberative reasoning as system one and system two. They're just kind of boring names, so I don't use them very much. But
that's like type 1 and type 2 error in statistics.
So boring. And they don't give
not only boring, but there's the type 3 error.
Type 3 error?
Yeah, it's never remembering what that's type 1 and type
2. Exactly. They give you no clue to remember what they refer to. But yes, system 1, intuition, system 2, deliberative reasoning. And so my point in the talk when I was discussing, you know, intuition versus deliberative reasoning is that both systems, as Massimo, you and I have discussed in the episode, have their strengths and weaknesses. And rationality is about trying to find the truest path to an accurate picture of reality, or about, you know, trying to optimize your decision making to, you know, to best achieve your goals, whatever they are. And so you don't rely on system two blindly. Of course, you decide based on this particular context which method is going to be the most likely one to get me, you know, most reliably to the truth or get me most reliably to achieving my goals. And so if you're in a situation that's really pressed for time or where you can't consider all the relevant factors, then the rational thing to do is to use your intuition.
Right.
Or if you know that you're a chess master with a lot of experience, you use your intuition. That's the most rational thing to do.
So,
but I think that people can, when they say it's possible to be too rational, they're thinking it's possible to be too deliberative.
Right, too analytical. Yeah.
Too analytical in situations where it's not actually the best strategy
you
for achieving the truth
it
or your goals.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And so I agree with that point. I just think that they're using the word rational there.
I agree.
Erroneously.
That's a very interesting distinction. I have one more piece of research that I want to show, bring up because I find it interesting. This gets a little closer to the question of expertise as opposed to the question of intuition per se. But as we said, the two are actually very much involved with each other because, you know, the intuition is a crucial part of becoming an expert. But there's some research that shows how people become experts. And that what that means is that you have structured knowledge, which becomes intuitive at some point about certain situations. And I found this particular example interesting as well as sort of amusing. Two researchers named Cindy Mello-Silver and Merav Green-Pfeffer have investigated the difference between superficial and structural knowledge, in other words, between the novice and sort of the expert, in the particular case of people's understanding of aquaria.
Of you know, aquaria?
Yeah, that's right. So tanks with fish.
Oh, aquariums.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, you were just saying it
that
in the
was
fancy
just
way.
The fancy plural way. Anyway, so what they did, they compared four groups of people and their understanding of fish tanks. Children, right? Naive adults. These are adults that have no particular interest in the subject matter.
Oh, naive with respect to this particular subject, not just naive people
exactly.
in general.
Exactly. And two different types of experts. One were biologists, and the other one were, you know, with an interest in ecology. And the other ones were hobbyists who care and you know, and build aquarium.
Hobbyists?
Hobbyists, yes. All right. So the non-surprising part of the research is, of course, that children and naive adults displayed, you know, a very simple understanding of the workings of the of an aquarium. They had no structural knowledge of the of how aquaria work. But the experts, on the other hand, were, of course, you know, they appreciated the systemic functioning of an aquarium, and they could describe sort of multiple causal pathways affecting the enclosed ecosystem, etc. But there were differences. The biologists explained things in terms of, and therefore conceptualized things, in terms of the science of ecosystems at a, you know, at a very abstract theoretical level. They thought of aquaria as a microcosm of natural of a natural ecosystem. The hobbyists, on the other hand, built their model. They were also expert, and they come up with the same similar conclusions to the biologists, but their structural knowledge was built around the mental model of practical issues dealing with filtering systems, feeding systems, you know, anything that plays in a direct role in actually keeping an aquarium, you know, good looking and clean. So the idea is that not only intuition and deliberative, you know, combination of intuition and deliberative thinking are the path, the long-term path to expertise. But there can be more than one type of structure knowledge and therefore more than one type of expertise even on the same domain, which means that I suspect that the biologists are actually going to have different intuitions from the hobbyists in this case about aquaria when in certain areas, because it's likely that their structural knowledge being structured differently and being based on a different kind of intuitions, it may in under certain conditions lead the two to make different decisions or to formulate a different understanding of the system, the complex system that they're interested in.
But one's still going to be more right than the other. Well, depending on the kind of question.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on the problem.
Oh, while we're sharing fun research related to intuition, I have just a couple of my favorite examples of intuitions gone awry that I'd like to share. One of them is a problem that I think it's sort of a staple on various deliberative reasoning tests, like not measuring people's ability to do deliberative reasoning, but their inclination to do deliberative reasoning. Ah. So questions to which you will get the wrong answer if you don't use deliberative reasoning. Right. They're easy once you do, but you know, you'll get them wrong if you don't. So this question was given to, among other subjects, a class at Princeton. The question is, a bat and a ball together add up to $1.10. That's how much they cost together. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Mm-hmm. I'm going to wait a minute for our listeners to think about it.
Okay.
Okay, so the answer which 50% of the class at Princeton gave, which is the intuitive system one answer, is that 10 cents, that the ball costs 10 cents, because you look at $1.10 and you look at a dollar and you take away the dollar and you get 10 cents. So essentially, like, what you're doing there with that process is you're not really thinking about the problem. You're just sort of feeling around for like, well, you know, what do problems like this generally involve? Well, generally you take one thing away from another. So I'll do that. Yeah. Of course, that's not actually the right answer, because if the ball was 10 cents and the bat was a dollar, then the bat would, you know, cost 90 cents more than the ball, not a dollar more than the ball. The right answer is 5 cents. So it just, you know, it shows how quickly that, you know, people, even, you know, smart, well-educated people reach for the system one answer, even on a test of reasoning, which presumably these people knew that they were being tested on. And then the other example of this intuitive reasoning that I find so amusing and kind of endearing is a classic social psychology experiment in which researchers sent someone to wait in line at a copy machine, and then the subject asked the person ahead of them, "Excuse me, do you mind if I cut in line?" And maybe about 50 or 40% of them agreed to let the subject cut in line ahead of them. But when the experimenters redid the study and had the subject ask, instead of "can I cut in front of you," but "can I cut in front of you because I need to make copies," then the assent rate went up to like 95% or something.
Because
really
now they have a reason.
Now they have a reason. It sounds like a reason. Like, but of course they need to make copies. It's the only reason they would have to cut in line at a copy machine. But because the request was phrased in, you know, terms of giving a reason, our system one reasoning kicks in and we go, "Oh, they have a reason. So sure, you have a reason. Go ahead."
You know, when I hear these kinds of things that I'm reminded of P.T. Barnum's saying that there's a sucker born every minute, and apparently most of us actually are in that category, at least under some circumstances.
Yep. That's true. We are just about running out of time, and we have a couple of good picks for this episode. So we will wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julia and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is... I'm continuing my trend of diverging from the standard book, website, movie, article model. My pick is an infographic this week.
Uh-huh.
So basically, this is from the website Information is Beautiful, which is a great source of really elegant and clever and interesting ways of depicting important data. So this one is called Snake Oil? Scientific Evidence for Popular Health Supplements. And I thought it fit really well into our wheelhouse for at least a couple of reasons. First, because the field of health and nutrition is just such a difficult field to pick through and find reliable information about. I find it personally very daunting. I tend to just throw up my hands and let, you know, other people I trust who have more time on their hands and more patience than me go through it. But so this infographic displays various like nutritional supplements ranging from, you know, things like fish oil to antioxidants to minerals like iron, just anything that you could take as a supplement to your diet. And it graphs them on this sort of constantly changing bubble chart, in which the bubbles that sort of float up to the top of the chart are the ones with the most reliable evidence for them.
I'm looking at it now. It's really beautiful.
It's beautiful, yeah. And it's, you can sort of see as when you load the page, the bubbles sort of like form and like gradually like nudge each other aside until they settle into place. And that their like hierarchy relative to each other depends on the current state of the evidence. I believe it's updated regularly. So it's just like a really clear, intuitive way of seeing what the top studies are. And then, it's also just a cool infographic because it conveys so much information in a really clear and non-confusing way. So the size of the bubble, each bubble is a particular supplement like garlic or green tea or vitamin D. And then, the size of the bubble conveys, how popular it is in terms of Google hits. So the big bubbles represent things that people care about. It's also a nice study in economy of information display. So it's of course important to know what condition the supplement is potentially useful for, because something might be really useful for, you know, heart disease, but not at all useful for right. Alzheimer's. So when you scroll your mouse over the bubble, it'll tell you what that particular supplement is being considered successful or unsuccessful with regard to. And then the color of the bubble, there are a few bubbles that are small or kind of far down, but they're colored orange so that you can see that like research is really accelerating in that area. So it's one to watch. So this has sort of become my favorite source of information about diet and health supplements,
both
functionally and just like aesthetically.
Very good. So my pick, on the other hand, is a book, which I have not finished. So I probably, arguably, shouldn't really recommend it.
So your pick is like the first 2/3 of this book?
About. So I find it interesting as an idea. It's well-written, and it's thought-provoking. The book is Zombie Economics, How Dead Ideas Still Walk Among Us. And it is by a New Zealand-based economist, John Quiggin. And the basic idea is that there's a number of ideas in economics that are dead and should be buried because they've been shown not to work. And they, just like zombies, come back to life, presumably, you know, against the evidence, in spite of the evidence, and presumably because there are sort of political or ideological interests and so on and so forth. So the book actually goes through five major ones, major ideas. I found, for instance, the article about the Great Moderation, which is the very first chapter, particularly interesting. The Great Moderation is this idea that the markets at some point in history have been tamed, and that these oscillations, you know, with bubbles and bursts have gone away. And this time they're gone away for sure, forever, because, you know, we figured it out how to tame the market. Apparently, this idea, which is called the Great Moderation, has been actually proposed several times, and sure enough, several times it's been shown to be wrong, because then a bubble actually has occurred, and then it has burst. And the last incarnation of this Great Moderation idea was popular until 2007. And, of course, in 2008, we had the worldwide collapse of the economy. So clearly, that was not a particularly good idea. Anyway, the author is, with humor and with a good amount of information and references, goes through these ideas. And in the process, it teaches you both about, you know, basics of economics, which I would think it's of general interest to people, but also about economics as a profession.
Mm-hmm. And sort of, you know, sociology of economics.
That's right, sociology of economics, and also to some extent epistemology of economics. That, you know, a lot of people, frankly, including myself, do have this impression that economics is just, you know, it's either entirely theoretical, when in which case it's basically pure mathematics, which is fine. But then when it comes to actual applications, economists don't necessarily know what the heck they're talking about. Now, as it turns out, that's not quite fair. They do know what they're talking about, except that occasionally there are other forces that come into, or perhaps more than occasionally, other forces that come into the field and sort of help the field forget temporarily that they actually had learned a lesson, and the lesson needs to be relearned all over. The thing, of course, that makes this somewhat tragic is that usually the lesson is learned on our backs, as when there is a, you know, collapse either at national level or a worldwide level. Anyway, so it's zombie economics, how that ideas still walk among us.
It sounds really interesting, and upon hearing your explanation, it's obvious that that is what I should have expected the book to be about. But I will admit, when I first heard the title Zombie Economics, I thought it was going to be about how zombies respond to incentives. Like, like if the price of brains goes up by 10 cents, do zombies consume less brains?
Well, they would have to, right?
All right, we are all out of time. So this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.